half its number in 2 or 3 years. An NKVD functionary who worked on the Baltic Quiet Sea Canal group of camps gave 196. Evidence that there were 250,000 prisoners in these camps at the beginning of the purges, and the death rate was 700 a day, a figure also 197. Given elsewhere. Tilde, however, 1,500 new prisoners came in daily, so the population continued to rise. The mortality rate of the camps in 1933 is estimated at about 10% per annum, and in 1938 to be running at about 20%. The 1936 prisoners were almost all extinct by 1940. A woman who worked in a camp hospital notes that patients sentenced in 1937 and 1938 filled it in 1939 and 1940, but by 1941 there were few of them to be seen. In any case, of those who went into the camps, only a small proportion ever came out again. For long, some of the best evidence we had came from German communists withdrawn from the camps and handed over to the Nazis in 1939 and 1940, from Poles released under the 1941 treaty, and from others who, benefiting from exceptional circumstances, were in for equally short periods. In general, releases were very rare, and survival until the post-Stalin amnesties rarer still. The length of sentence anyhow made little difference. Those who were released were in any case all rearrested around 1947, 1948. Upon the expiration of a sentence, it was usual for prisoners to be called before a special section officer and given a few more years, though in some cases they were sent back to prison in Moscow or elsewhere, reinterrogated, and sentenced for fresh crimes. Shukov sort of liked the way they pointed at him, the lucky guy nearly through with his sentence. But he didn't really believe it. Take the fellows who should have been let out in the war. They were all kept until 46, till further notice. And then those with 3 years who'd gotten five more slapped on. They twisted the law any way they wanted. You finished a 10-year stretch and they gave you another one. Or if not, they still wouldn't let you go home. We do know of people who lasted up to 17 years and were then rehabilitated, Snigov, referred to in Khrushchev's secret speech, for instance, or Lieutenant General Todorsky. They seem to have served in the less severe camps. But much of the published Soviet evidence until 1987 was from figures such as Gorbatov, who was among the rehabilitated officers of 1940 and would not otherwise have survived. The routine of rehabilitation, in those few cases in which it applied, was slow. Gorbatov had, he later found out, been defended by Badeni, and on March 20, 1940 his sentence was rescinded and a review ordered. He did not get back from Magadan to the Butyrka until December 25, 1940. By March 1, 1941 he was in the Lubyanka, and on 5 March he was released. The other sort of Soviet witness was of the type of Solzhenitsyn, who says that though a man might possibly last 10 years, any much longer period was out of the question, and this at a comparatively good period in camp history. Solzhenitsyn was in fact released after 10 years, in the post-Stalin rehabilitations. He had fortunately been sentenced late in Stalin's life. A man sentenced in 1938 would have had to wait 17 or 18 years. Of those arrested in the period 1936 to 1938, we can hardly allow 10% to have survived. In fact, a Soviet historian tells us that 90% of those who went to camp before the war perished, while academician Sakharov notes that only 50,000 of the more than 600,000 party members sent to camp, rather than executed, survived. A million would be an outside figure. Of the other 7 million odd, the number who died either by execution or in camps during the actual two-year Yazhov period may be taken as about 3 million. The rest followed over a period of years, during which time their number was continually added to by the victims of later arrest. A recent Soviet article puts it that their death was caused by unbearable toil, by cold and starvation, by unheard of degradation and humiliation, by a life which could not have been endured by any other mammal. In another we read, "I often hear the word lucky from those I am recording. I was lucky, the firing squad was replaced by 25 years of hard labor, lucky, Lee waited for hours on the tundra to be shot but wasn't, lucky, I was transferred from general work to the meteorological station, lucky, I had enough time to take my daughter to my parents before the arrest, lucky. One day we shall learn how many people died in the prisons and camps and how many returned." A Soviet poet wrote as long ago as 1963, in Izvestia. There, row on row, according to years, Kalama, Magadan, Vorkuta and Nara marched in invisible columns. The region of eternal frost wrote men off into eternity. Moved them from the category of living to that of dead, little difference between them behind that barbed wire. White and grizzled. with that special article of the law code clipped to their case files. Who and what for and by whose will? 205. Figure it out, history. The Great Trial. Le dernier acte est sanglant, quelque belle case while la comédie en tout le reste. 12. Pascal. Preparations for the greatest trial of all were in less expert hands than those which had produced the Zinoviev and Pyatakov shows. The NKVD veterans had gone. Agranov had by now followed Yagoda and his staff, being in 1937 expelled from the party for systematic breaches of socialist legality, or so a later Soviet footnote has it, as if asking us to believe that such practices were frowned on by the party leadership of that year. He died, presumed shot, in 1938. His wife was also shot. Instead of Molchanov and Mironov, Agranov and Gay, Yezhov's team for the 1938 trial consisted basically of the experienced Zakovsky, promoted from Leningrad, Mikhail Frinovsky, who under Yagoda had been commander of the NKVD's frontier troops, I. Shapiro, head of Yezhov's secretariat and of the new section for investigating specially important cases, and to some extent Slutsky of the Foreign Department. They were all themselves to perish, but meanwhile they had after all contrived a show not grossly inferior to its two predecessors. The plot was more complicated, and more horrifying, and there were faults of detail which attracted the censure of the stricter critics. But on the whole, it was a fair success. It might be thought, as we have said, that no public trial was now necessary. The opposition and the semi-independent voices among Stalin's own supporters had been crushed. The third trial was in this sense little more than a victory parade. It brought together publicly every type of opposition, terror, sabotage, treachery, and espionage, and turned them into branches of one single great conspiracy. For the 1936 trial, Molchanov had prepared for Stalin a special diagram, a system of many colored lines on the diagram indicated when and through whom Trotsky had communicated with the leaders of the conspiracy in the USSR. Such a diagram showing all the links in the Bukharin case would be one of great complexity. The trial, which opened in the October Hall on March 2, 1938, had, indeed, taken over a year to prepare, but it was a production of far greater scope than the others. For all the threads were now pulled together. The rightists, Bukharin, and Rykov, were linked to Trotsky, to the earlier Zinovievite and Trotskyite plotters, to Trotskyites, hitherto considered ex-Trotskyites, who had not yet been tried, to the usual dozens of terrorist action groups, to the espionage organizations of several powers. They had set up at least two reserve centers, they had been involved in Yanukidze's plots, and they were closely concerned with that of Tukhachevsky. They had formed organizational connections with underground nationalist conspirators in half a dozen of the non-Russian Soviet republics. Their own rightist grouping had involved dozens of men thought to be loyal Stalinists, in high positions in the state. And, as a final touch, they had throughout had as a major accomplice Yagoda, with all his leading subordinates. As Vladimir Voinovich comments of the shorthand report of the trial in the Ivankiad. Don't regard it as a document, for it is not a document, don't think about methods of investigation, about why Krestinsky first offered one story, then another. Regard it as a work of art. And you will agree that you've never read anything like it in all of world literature. What well-defined characters. What a grandiose plot, and how cohesive and integrated everything was. It's just too bad that the characters were living people, otherwise you might be able to stand reading it. Registered. In the dingy winter daylight and under the stale glare of the electric lamps, a wide variety of prisoners sat in the dock. In the first trial, Zinoviev and Kamenev, and to a lesser extent Smirnov and Yevdokimov, were the only well-known figures. The second, with Pyatakov, Rodik, and Sokolnikov, was less impressive still. And in each case, the supporting cast consisted mainly of third-rate alleged terrorists and only slightly more interesting engineers. This time, three members of Lenin's Politburo stood in the dock: Bukharin, Rykov, and Krestinsky. With them were the legendary Rykovsky, leader of the Balkan and Ukrainian revolutionary movements, and the sinister figure of Yagoda, the secret police personified, looking right and left with a certain rat-like vitality. A group of the most senior officials of the Stalinist state who had for many years served it uncritically formed the bulk of the accused: Rosengoltz, Ivanov, Chernov, and Grinko, all people's commissars until the previous year, Zelensky, head of the cooperatives, and Sharangovich, first secretary in Belorussia. For the first time, two Asians, the Uzbek leaders Kodzaev and Ikramov, denounced the previous year for bourgeois nationalism, took their places beside the European accused. These main political accused were supplemented by five minor figures: Besenov, who had worked in the Soviet trade delegation in Berlin, Zubarev, an official of the Agriculture Commissariat, and the former secretaries of Yagoda, of Kuibyshev, and of Maxim Gorky. Last, by fearful innovation, there were three men far from public life, the doctors Plevnev, Levin, and Kozakov, the first two highly distinguished in their field and the oldest men in Doc, 66 and 68, respectively. The indictment was a comprehensive one, of espionage, wrecking, undermining Soviet military power, provoking a military attack on the USSR, plotting the dismemberment of the USSR, and overthrowing the social system in favor of a return to capitalism. For these purposes, the accused had assembled this vast conspiracy of Trotskyites, Zinovievites, rightists, underscore Mensheviks, socialist revolutionaries, and bourgeois nationalists from the whole Soviet periphery. They had been in close cooperation with the military plotters. A number of them had been spies of Germany, Britain, Japan, and Poland since the early 1920s. Several of them had been Tsarist agents in the revolutionary movement. Wrecking had been committed in industry, agriculture, trade, and finance. On the terror side, they had been responsible for the assassination of Kirov, which Yagoda had facilitated through Zaporozhye's. But in addition, they had caused the deaths of Kuibyshev and of Maxim Gorky, hitherto regarded as natural, and of the former OGPA chief, Menzinsky, and of Gorky's son Peshkov into the bargain. This had been done by medical murder. Yagoda was also charged with an attempt to poison Yazhov, and a variety of the more usual fruitless plans to assassinate Stalin and other leaders were also alleged. A brand new charge, against Bukharin alone of those in Doc, was of having plotted to seize power in 1918 and to murder Lenin and Stalin at the same time. We are now told that when, 13 months later, Frinovsky was himself interrogated, he recounted how he had prepared witnesses in this trial, and then brought them before Yazhov, who warned them not to change their stories in the public trial. If at any point before then they retracted, they were returned to interrogation. But this 1939 confession by Frinovsky was not thought to necessitate any revising of the 1938 verdict. We also learn that rehearsals were held, and a recent Soviet document tells us how Yazhov more than once talked with Rykov, Bukharin, Bulanov, and assured each of them that they would not be shot. To Bukharin, he said, "Conduct yourself well in the trial, I will promise you they will not shoot you." Once again Ulrich presided, assisted by Machilovich and a new junior figure, Yevlev. And once again, Vyshinsky conducted the prosecution. Only the three doctors had defense counsel, and they were represented by two of the same lawyers who had done their bit for the prosecution in the same roles in the Pyatakov trial. A confession withdrawn. The first sensation of the trial came almost at once, when the accused were asked their pleas. These were all the usual guilty, until Krestinsky was reached. Krestinsky, a pale, seedy, dim little figure, his steel-rimmed spectacles perched on his beaky nose, replied firmly to Ulrich. "I plead not guilty. I am not a Trotskyite. I was never a member of the Bloc of Rights and Trotskyites, of whose existence I was not aware. Nor have I committed any of the crimes with which I personally am charged. In particular, I plead not guilty to the charge of having had connections with the German intelligence service." "The do you corroborate the confession you made at the president, preliminary investigation?" Krestinsky, "Yes, at the preliminary investigation I confessed, but I have never been a Trotskyite. The I repeat the question, do you plead guilty?" President. Krestinsky, "Before my arrest I was a member of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, Bolsheviks, and I remain one now. The do you plead guilty to the charge of participating in president, espionage activities and of participating in terrorist activities?" Krestinsky, "I have never been a Trotskyite. I have never belonged to the Bloc of Rights and Trotskyites and have not committed a single crime." After the pleas, the court recessed for 20 minutes. It has been suggested that this was to give time to put a little pressure on Krestinsky. Probably, but the recess was only 5 minutes longer than that at the previous trials. The court proceeded with the examination of Besenov, who from his post as counselor in the Soviet embassy in Berlin was the alleged contact man with Trotsky and Sadov. Besenov, a grim, gray-faced man with the air of an automaton, had been arrested on February 28, 1937, the day after Bukharin and Rykov. He had denied the main charges until December 30, 1937, when a combination of torture and the conveyor finally broke him. But meanwhile, he had been tried on 13 August before the military collegium of the Supreme Court, composed of almost the same people as in the present trial, which neither acquitted nor condemned him, but sent the case for further examination. This can hardly mean other than that it had been decided to save him for a major trial, as a minor diplomat, and ex-socialist revolutionary, He was bound to be purged in any case. He must have appeared a suitable courier. The case is comparable with that of the Komsomols of 1935, saved for the Zinoviev trial. When Bessonov now confessed that he had indeed been involved in Trotskyite plots with Krestinsky, Vyshinsky referred to Krestinsky's refusal to admit this. Bessonov smiled. Vyshinsky asked, "Why are you smiling?" Bessonov replied, "The reason why I am standing here is that Nikolai Nikolayevich Krestinsky named me as the liaison man with Trotsky. Besides him and Pyatakov, nobody knew about this. Something of the mechanics of confessions implicating others, and of the whole tangled net of moral responsibility, comes through." In his final plea, Bessonov was to remark that it was not until Krestinsky implicated him in October 1937 that his resistance to interrogation started to become hopeless. In general, after Bessonov had made a few points about connections with Sadov and Pyatakov, his examination was largely turned into an excuse for baiting Krestinsky. The latter admitted he had met Bessonov in the West, but denied any Trotskyite links. Vyshinsky, "And about Trotskyite affairs?" Krestinsky, "We did not talk about them. I was not a Trotskyite." Vyshinsky, "You never talked about them." Krestinsky, "Vyshinsky." Krestinsky, "Vyshinsky." Krestinsky, "Vyshinsky, Krestinsky, Vyshinsky, Krestinsky, Vyshinsky, Krestinsky." "Never." "That means that Bessonov is not telling the truth, and that you are telling the truth. Do you always tell the truth?" "No. Not always." "Accused Krestinsky, you and I will have to examine serious matters and there is no need to get excited. Consequently, Bessonov is not telling the truth?" "No. But you too do not always tell the truth. Is that not so?" "I did not always tell the truth during the investigation." "But at other times you always tell the truth?" "The truth." "Why this lack of respect for the investigation? Why during the investigation did you tell untruths? Explain." No reply. A few minutes later, Bessonov spoke of Krestinsky's formulations. Vyshinsky interrupted in an unpleasant tone, "Briefly, because I think that Krestinsky will himself talk about these purposes later." And, after Bessonov had made his point, Vyshinsky turned to Krestinsky and asked, "Accused Krestinsky, do you recall such diplomatic conversations with Bessonov?" Krestinsky answered firmly, "No, we never had such conversations." 9918. 2 minutes later, it was. Vyshinsky, "Krestinsky. You do not remember the details, but Bessonov does. There was not a word said about the Trotskyite stand. Finally, the question of Krestinsky's confession was faced directly. Vyshinsky. "But what about your admission?" Krestinsky. Vyshinsky. Krestinsky, Vyshinsky. Krestinsky. Vyshinsky, Krestinsky. "During the investigation I gave false testimony several times. You said, I did not formally belong to the Trotskyite Center. Is that true or not?"
"I did not belong to it at all."
"You say that formally you did not belong. What is true and what is not true here? Perhaps it is all true, or it is all untrue, or only half of it is true? What percentage, how many grams of it are true?"
"I did not belong to the Trotskyite Center because I was not a Trotskyite."
"You were not a Trotskyite?"
"No."
Krestinsky went on to point out that he had abandoned Trotsky in 1927.
Krestinsky.
Vyshinsky.
Krestinsky.
Vyshinsky.
Krestinsky.
Vyshinsky. Krestinsky. "I date my rupture with Trotsky and Trotskyism from November 27, 1927, when, through Serebrakov, who had returned from America and was in Moscow, I sent Trotsky a sharp letter containing sharp criticism. That letter is not in the records. We have another letter, your letter to Trotsky. The letter I am referring to is in the possession of the court investigator, because it was taken from me during the search, and I request this letter to be attached to the records. The records contain a letter dated July 11, 1927, taken from you during the search. But there is another letter of 27th of November. There is no such letter. That cannot be." 7. This was to be significant. Pressed continually in a long exchange, Krestinsky gave his motives for earlier confessions.
Krestinsky, "At the preliminary investigation, before I was questioned by you, I had given false testimony."
Vyshinsky, "And then you stuck to it."
Krestinsky, "And then I stuck to it, because from personal experience I had arrived at the conviction that before the trial, if there was to be one, I would not succeed in refuting my testimony."
Vyshinsky now called on Rosengoltz, who confirmed Krestinsky's Trotskyism.
Krestinsky, who had not been feeling well, slumped. Vyshinsky told him to listen. He replied that when he had taken a pill, he would be all right, but asked not to be questioned for a few minutes. Rosengoltz, then Grinko, gave evidence of Krestinsky's guilt. Krestinsky, recovering, continued to deny it. Vyshinsky, here are three men on good terms with you who say what is not true? Krestinsky, yes. After several more denials, Vyshinsky again asked him directly, when we interrogated you at the preliminary investigation, what did you say on this score? Krestinsky, in giving testimony I did not refute any of my previous testimony, which I deliberately confirmed. Vyshinsky, you deliberately confirmed it. You were misleading the prosecutor. Is that so, or not? Krestinsky, no. Vyshinsky, why did you have to mislead me? Krestinsky, I simply considered that if I were to say what I am saying today, that it was not in accordance with the facts, my declaration would not reach the leaders of the party and the government. This clear statement of the position was greeted with a shocked hush from the audience. Questioning further about the preliminary examination, Vyshinsky asked, if you were asked whether you had complaints, you should have answered that you had. And Krestinsky replied, I had in the sense that I did not speak voluntarily. Vyshinsky then abandoned this line of questioning and turned to his official prey, Besenov, who developed his connections with Trotsky at length, adding that Trotsky had hinted at the physical extermination of Maxim Gorky. The session ended with a further exchange with, and denial from, Krestinsky. After a two-hour adjournment, the evening started off with the evidence of Grinko, former People's Commissar for Finance. He had been a Bordbist, and in the early 1920s had been dismissed from his post as Ukrainian Commissar for Education for excessive haste in carrying out Ukrainianization. In this capacity, he now implicated Lashenko and other lesser Ukrainians, such as Poryko, deputy chairman of the Ukrainian Council of People's Commissars, as members of the National Fascist Organization. In his Moscow role, he brought in a number of other leading figures, such as Antipov, Rudzutak, Yakovlev, and Varikis, as rightist plotters. He described how Yakirin Gamemnik had instructed the head of the Department of Savings Banks to prepare a terrorist act against Yuzhov, and how other conspirators had arranged for an official of the Northern Sea Route to do the same against Stalin. His own main activity had been financial sabotage, which he had defined at the preliminary examination. The main object of undermining work in the People's Commissariat of Finance was the following: to weaken the Soviet ruble, to weaken the financial power of the USSR, to dislocate the economy and thus rouse among the population discontent with the financial policy of the Soviet power, discontent over taxes, discontent with bad savings bank service, delays in paying wages, etc., which were to result in wide, organized discontent with the Soviet power and were to help the conspirators to recruit adherents and to develop insurrectionary activities. This sort of theme, the blaming of all the errors and malpractices of the Soviet economy on sabotage by the accused, was to run through the trial. For all spheres of life, there was someone in the dock to answer for popular discontents. And the evidence tells us a huge amount about Soviet conditions. Grinko, similarly, had been involved with Zelensky and others in trade holdups. Grinko, Baladin and the People's Commissariat of Internal Trade, carried on undermining activities, created a shortage of goods difficulties in the country. Zelensky, on the instructions of the Bloc of Rights and Trotskyites, sent huge quantities of goods to the districts where there was a poor harvest and small quantities of goods to the districts where there were good harvests, and this caused goods to remain on the shelves in some districts and a shortage of goods in others. But once again, Vyshinsky diverged to attack Krestinsky. Again he was rebuffed by a firm, I deny that I talked with fascists for Trotskyite purposes. At this, Rykov was called on. He, too, confirmed Krestinsky's guilt. Krestinsky once more asserted flatly that he knew nothing of any illegal activities, and the intervention of Ulrich could get no more out of him. But Rykov, too, proved unsatisfactory, though in a different way. In the period before his arrest, he had taken to heavy drinking, and reduced himself to a bad condition which the long strain of his imprisonment had, in its different way, done nothing to help. During cross-examination, he sometimes seemed to have gone to pieces, punctuating his answers with inane giggles. But he rallied. At first he was vague. Grinko, from Rykov I learned that Yagoda belonged to this organization, but I had no direct connections with Yagoda. Vyshinsky, to the court, permit me to question Rykov. Accused Rykov, did you tell Grinko about this? Rykov, I do not remember exactly, but I cannot exclude such a fact. Vyshinsky, hence, you told him about Yagoda's membership? Rykov, yes. Now, Reking was raised. Vyshinsky, accused Rykov, Do you corroborate this conversation with Grinko about wrecking? Rykov, I don't accept that. I deny it, not because I want to minimize my guilt. I have done much worse things than this. But then he got into his stride on the line, which both he and, much more forcefully and consistently, Bukharin were to take throughout. That is, they admitted forming an illegal organization, confessed to giving it a terrorist orientation, accepted full responsibility in the abstract for all the acts allegedly committed, but denied personal knowledge of or connection with any particular crime. They were thus able to point out that they were freely confessing to capital crimes, so that their denials of the particular acts could not be interpreted as attempts to evade the penalty. The last to be examined on 2nd of March was Chernov. Ex-Menshevik and ex-theological student, like Besenov and Mikoyan Stalin, he had been in charge of grain collection in the Ukraine in 1929 and 1930, and had more recently been serving as All-Union People's Commissar for Agriculture. He had been a ruthless executor of Stalin's will in the collectivization campaign, but apparently not a convinced one. He is reported as having said, during the 1930 slaughter of their livestock by the peasantry, that at least for the first time in their sordid history, the Russian peasants have eaten their fill of meat. He had started to confess on the day of his arrest. He now confessed to qualms about collectivization, and admitted sharing them, at the time, with a wide range of Ukrainian officials, including Zatansky. But his main role in the dock was to take the blame for agricultural failures. He had only been removed from his post on October 30, 1937, and could reasonably be blamed for much. For example, there had been a good deal of livestock mortality. Back in September 1937, a spread of infective anemia among Soviet horses had been countered by the arrest of the head of the Veterinary Administration of the People's Commissariat of Agriculture, Dakin, the head of the Veterinary Services of the Red Army, trademark Nikolsky, and a leading veterinary official in the Agricultural Commissariat, Chernyak, whose forthcoming trial was announced. They had never again been heard of, but Chernov was now able to accept the blame for similar epidemics, spread through the agency of a different set of veterinarians. Chernov, I performed the following acts of diversion. In order to cause heavy cattle mortality in eastern Siberia, I instructed Ginsburg, chief of the veterinary department, who belonged to the Organization of the Rights, and Thrun, the chief of the veterinary supply department, who also belonged to the Organization of the Rights, not to supply anti-anthrax serum to eastern Siberia, knowing that eastern Siberia was particularly liable to anthrax. The serum was not supplied to eastern Siberia. The preparations for this were made in 1935, and when there was an outbreak of anthrax there in 1936, it turned out that no serum was available, with the result that I cannot say how many exactly, but at any rate over 25,000 horses perished. Secondly, I instructed Ginsburg and Boryarshinov, chief of the bacteriological department, to artificially infect pigs with erysipelas in the Leningrad region and with plague in the Voronezh region and the Azov Black Sea territory. It is difficult to estimate the results, but at any rate it may be taken for granted that several tens of thousands of pigs perished owing to this diversive act. And a variety of other agricultural sabotage schemes, such as wrong types of crop rotation, the provision of bad seed, and so on, contributed to lowering the harvest yield. In Chernov's Ukrainian period, he had also undertaken to incense the middle peasants and Ukrainian national feeling generally by attributing the policies he had pursued to orders from Moscow. He had contacted Mensheviks abroad, and become a German spy. Rykov was his main connection in the rightist center. Recalled, the ex-premier again admitted the plot, but denied approving the actions. All that he says is essentially and fundamentally true, but as to the part in which he said that I was in favor of distortions of the agricultural policy, it seems to me he is wrong. On the overthrow of the Soviet power, Rykov added, I do not remember having such a conversation with Chernov, but of course the possibility of such a conversation is not precluded. Finally, he denied various meetings with Chernov for wrecking purposes, and when Chernov said that to have neglected to give such instructions would have marked him as a very poor rightist leader, he answered sardonically, perhaps I should have done as he says. It was a mistake on my part. At which Ulrich abruptly closed the day's session. The next day, 3rd of March, started with the ex-medical student Ivanov, former People's Commissar for the timber industry. He had, of course, sabotaged that industry, on instructions from Rosengoltz. Referring to the timber dumping, which was a notorious aspect of Soviet trade policy in the early 1930s, he said, the most valuable timber was sold at reduced prices. This involved a loss to the Soviet state of several million rubles in foreign currency. Bukharin explained this measure as being an advance to the British bourgeoisie in return for the support it had promised. Otherwise, he said, we would not be taken seriously, and we would forfeit confidence. In the internal administration of lumbering, his main aim, curiously enough, had been the disruption of culture. Attention was chiefly devoted to hindering the technical re-equipment of lumbering, preventing the fulfillment of the plans of capital construction, especially in the cellulose and paper industry, in this way placing the country on a short paper ration and aiming a blow at the Cultural Revolution. Interrupting the supply of exercise books and thus rousing discontent among the masses. He confessed also to having been involved in the left communist movement against Lenin, and to various attempts to organize insurrectionary bands, partly on British orders, and terrorist groups. In this connection, Bukharin was now questioned. He said he had ordered the formation of illegal organizations, but not insurrectionary bands. He had, though at a later date than that given by Ivanov, propounded an insurrectionary orientation, the Ryudin platform. He had given no actual instructions for insurrectionary preparations, but he accepted the responsibility, in that a practical worker like Ivanov would doubtless go on to action on such a basis. When Vyshinsky said to him, hence, Ivanov's statements about connections with the British intelligence service, he interrupted, I was totally uninformed about the intelligence service. The next questioning should, according to schedule, have been that of Krestinsky. But instead, a minor agricultural specialist from Chernov's commissariat, Zubarev, appeared. He gave a good deal of evidence about disrupting the food supply. Vyshinsky, tell us the nature of your wrecking activities. Zubarev, causing confusion in seed cultivation, lowering the quality of the seeds, employing bad quality materials, bad sifting, careless storing, and the result of all this was not only a reduction in yield, but also a hostile mood of the peasantry, dissatisfaction with these so-called selected seeds. My criminal activities consisted first of all in wrongly planting the sowing of vegetables. Exactly the same kind of work was carried on in respect to retarding the development of fruit tree nurseries. In respect to state farms, the main wrecking activities were that up to the last moment no proper rotation of crops was established, and in a number of state farms there was no rotation of crops at all. All this naturally reduced the yields. A large number of state farms which possess large herds of cattle were left without fodder owing to the wrong crop rotation, and as a result we had the dying off of cattle and slow development of the livestock farming. And so on and so on. As well as with the Wrights, he established connections with Miralov from the 1937 trial. He had also organized a terrorist group in the agriculture commissariat, choosing Molotov as the prospective victim. He had carried out agricultural spying for Germany. Zubarev's main contribution, however, was his recruitment as a Tsarist agent in 1908 and later. For Vyshinsky now produced a surprise witness. This was a police inspector of pre-revolutionary days, Vasilyev, who had allegedly recruited Zubarev. The production of this aged Tsarist gendarme was treated by the court and public as a sort of comic turn. Even Vyshinsky was comparatively amiable to him, baiting him only with that puny malice which was the closest he could evidently get to good humor. With that, the morning session dragged to a close. When the court reassembled at 6 p.m., Ulrich announced to a tense court that the examination of Krestinsky would now take place. Vyshinsky interposed to say that he first wanted to put a few questions to Rakovsky. He asked the old Bulgarian about the letter to Trotsky abandoning Trotskyism, which Krestinsky had referred to in the previous day's session. Rakovsky recalled it, and said it had been intended as a deception, and that Krestinsky had never broken with Trotskyism. Vyshinsky then produced the letter, whose existence he would not acknowledge the previous day, and went on to argue that the letter itself, which spoke of the defeat of the opposition and the need to work in the party, should be interpreted as a call to underhand subversion, a possible argument, indeed, but one scarcely compatible with an out-and-out deceptive surrender. Finally he turned to Krestinsky. Did he accept this formulation? Krestinsky, who was looking more than ever like a small bedraggled sparrow, accepted it. Vyshinsky asked if this meant that Krestinsky would now cease to deceive the court. The answer was a full confirmation of the evidence given at the preliminary inquiry. He admitted his guilt. On the first day, Krestinsky had occasionally been roused by Vyshinsky's taunts, but on the whole his tone is said to have been natural, it had now become flat and desperate. Vyshinsky pressed the point. I have one question to ask Krestinsky. What, then, is the meaning of the statement you made yesterday, which cannot be regarded otherwise than as a piece of Trotskyite provocation in court? Krestinsky, yesterday, under the influence of momentary keen feeling of false shame, evoked by the atmosphere of the dock and the painful impression created by the public reading of the indictment, which was aggravated by my poor health, I could not bring myself to tell the truth, I could not bring myself to say that I was guilty. And instead of saying yes, I am guilty, I almost mechanically answered, "No, I am not guilty." Wyshynski, mechanically? Krestinsky, in the face of world public opinion, I had not the strength to admit the truth that I had been conducting a Trotskyite struggle all along. I request the court to register my statement that I fully and completely admit that I am guilty of all the gravest charges brought against me personally, and that I admit my complete responsibility for the treason and treachery I have committed. And now, despite Ulrich's earlier announcement that the examination of Krestinsky was due, Wyshynski at once dropped him and turned to the examination of Rykov. All this has very much the air of the prosecution playing safe, and not willing to risk a further retraction at this stage. Stalin received regular reports on the case and gave advice. The latest Soviet account says that after he was informed of Krestinsky's retraction, he said, "You worked badly with that filth," and ordered a stop to be put to Krestinsky's talk. On the night of 2nd of March, special measures were taken. The interrogators dislocated his left shoulder, so that outwardly there was nothing to be seen. Besenov is named as having told this version to the German engineer Hans Metzger in a prisoner's transfer train in 1939. According to another variant, Krestinsky was also faced for hours with a battery of particularly bright lights, which damaged his already injured eyes, but only consented to confess on condition that the letter he had written to Trotsky should be put in the records. And if Krestinsky had hoped to rouse the other defendants to defy the court, he had had to recognize defeat. Indeed, he may never have hoped or intended his retraction to go beyond the first day, making what demonstration he felt to be in his power. An alternative account leaked through NKVD circles was that Krestinsky's retraction and reaffirmation were a put-up job. Stalin was wishing to show that the defendants did not all confess like automata and thought that this single and temporary lapse would add a touch of verisimilitude. The arguments against this notion are very powerful. Krestinsky's phrasing during the first day sounds, on the face of it, genuine, and some of the points he makes seem to be both valid and extremely embarrassing to the prosecution. Wyshynski's attitude is sinister in a way which appears more compatible with a genuine threat to Krestinsky than the appeal to his reason and conscience, which would be supposed to have produced the change in his evidence on the second day. There is another and most suggestive piece of evidence from the trial itself. At the beginning, Wyshynski announced the order in which he proposed to question the 21 prisoners. This was evidently a predetermined list, since it is repeated in the order in which they made their final pleas, except for one transposition among the minor characters. But the actual order of questioning was different. The first day went according to schedule: Besenov, Grinko, Chernov. But on the second, Krestinsky should have had his examination in chief immediately after Ivanov. Instead, as we saw, the agricultural official Zubarev took the stand on the morning of 3rd of March, and in the afternoon Krestinsky was called upon not for a full examination, but only for a brief recantation. This, too, was preceded by the short and unscheduled interrogation of Rakovsky, undermining Krestinsky's point about the letter disavowing Trotskyism. On the evening of 3rd of March, this was all that Krestinsky's examination amounted to. His full examination was postponed until the following afternoon, when the examinations of Rosenkolz and Rakovsky were rescheduled, the former to proceed and the latter to follow Krestinsky's. Rosenkolz, as Krestinsky's alleged closest Trotskyite collaborator, established both Krestinsky's connections with Trotsky and the joint plotting activity of himself, Krestinsky, and the Tukhachevsky group in the days after the Pyatakov trial and Bukharin's arrest. Krestinsky confirmed and elaborated all this, and Rakovsky rubbed it in afterward. All this seems to show an emergency procedure. Nor is it difficult to see that the circumstances of his original interrogation were such as to make retraction possible. Krestinsky had been arrested at the end of May 1937. He confessed after the lapse of a week, at the end of the first interrogation. This was by torture in its most intensive form, and he was not, therefore, broken in the long drawn-out fashion described on here. It was just at that time that Bukharin was making his first confession, and it may be that it was momentarily intended to produce the next big trial at very short notice, and about as soon after the Pyatakov trial as that had been after Zinoviev's. If so, this perhaps came to nothing when Bukharin started to retract some of his confession, see here, and the whole business of interrogating him had to begin over again. Meanwhile, with the spread of the purge right through the party, other useful additions to the case kept emerging, and it was 9 months later that the trial took place. However that may be, it is certainly the case that the NKVD seems to have had in its hands a leading prisoner who had not been brought into the right state for a trial by the most tried and successful procedure. Torture and the conveyor could produce confessions, but, as we have seen, the victim, once rested, recovered to the degree that he could retract them. He was not reduced to the degree of submission obtained by the longer method. Yet Krestinsky had confessed, and was being cooperative. There was no overt resistance to break. Krestinsky's withdrawal of his confession was not unprecedented. During the Schacht trial, one of the accused, Scorato, had refused to confess, been kept out of the court for a day on the grounds of illness, and then come back and confessed, only to withdraw the confession again, and the following day to reaffirm it. Again, in the Metrovic trial, McDonald withdrew, then reaffirmed, his original confession. It has never been thought that these withdrawals added anything to the credibility of the confession when finally produced. Thus the argument that Stalin had planned the whole Krestinsky episode is a weak one. What seems more probable is that some such story was put round within the outer circles of the NKVD to account for the lapse. Another theory is that Krestinsky was replaced in the dock by a double or an actor. Observers present felt that it was someone different who appeared in the later phase of the trial. That Krestinsky did not appear to be the same Krestinsky after hours of NKVD attention seems natural enough. And recent long accounts in the Soviet press do not make the suggestion, speaking, in fact, of his reaffirming his confession after being suitably worked over. In any case, Krestinsky's withdrawal, so dramatic and so cogent in its cornments, barely affected the reception given to the trial by the foreign public. Stalin had won again. An ex-premier. Rykov's examination-in-chief came almost as an anti-climax. It started off mildly, soon coming to the alleged complicity of Yagoda in rightist activity back in 1929. And now Yagoda, in turn, was questioned and gave one of those half-hearted affirmatives which any objective observer might have interpreted as a negative, the fact is true, but not as Rykov puts it. Rykov, who is said to have been tortured quite brutally, still managed to inject a tone of irony into some of his remarks. He went on to describe the supposed riotist underground which arose after 1930. He then came to the Ryutin platform, which, he said, he, Tomsky, Bukharin, Vasily Schmidt, and Erglanov had been responsible for. Ryutin had merely fronted for them, and Yagoda's protection had saved the main culprits. The platform. Recognized, as far as I remember, and I do remember, for I had a share in editing it, methods of violence in changing the leadership of the party and of the country, terrorism and uprisings. It was formulated so broadly as to constitute an instruction that measures of violence should be applied in whatever forms might prove to be at our disposal. The rightists were, he added, a large organization. It was not a question of 100 or so people, but of numerous cadres, so that it was understandable that the name Ivanov has no place in my memory. Palpable irony about a people's commissar and full member of the Central Committee. When it came to Kulak insurrections, Bukharin too was called on, and both Rykov and Bukharin admitted vaguely a connection with one in Siberia. Its location was put to Bukharin, who could not remember if the one given was right. He, too, mentioned the Ryutin platform. I have been questioned so many times about the Ryutin platform. Rykov now admitted to forming a terrorist organization headed by his former secretary, Ekaterina Artemenko, which he had instructed to watch for passing government automobiles, without result. He and Bukharin, again questioned, admitted forming another terrorist group, headed by a former socialist revolutionary, to assassinate Stalin and Kaganovich, but again without result. But both men were unsatisfactory as to details. Rykov said, the center did not adopt a decision in such and such a year to kill such and such a member of the political bureau or the government. The center took means that would enable such a decision to be put into effect if one were adopted, at which point he was understandably interrupted by Vyshinsky. Bukharin, asked on whose initiative Semyonov, the socialist revolutionary, had acted, said, I do not remember. Perhaps it was mine. At all events, I do not deny it. Rykov involved the rightists with the supposed plan of 1935 to seize power, with Yanukitsa, Yagoda, Peterson, and others, which had also, he said, implicated Tukhachevsky and other generals. We did not, he added, succeed in making a real attempt. He went on to the connections with fascism, Menshevism, bourgeois nationalism, and other groupings. But as to detail, he again said he could only suspect, not know, what Grinko represented, and when Grinko was now called on, Rykov said, I do not remember, when asked if his evidence was correct. There followed a further three-way exchange between Vyshinsky, Rykov, and Bukharin on the dismemberment of the USSR and defeatism. Bukharin said that he did not take a defeatist line, but I'm responsible for this affair. Rykov broke down and admitted the whole defeatist position on his own behalf and that of all the rightists, but withdrew a suggestion he had made at the preliminary inquiry, that Bukharin was the man mainly responsible. At this, Vyshinsky openly expressed his annoyance. After further confession to treasonable actions in Belarusia, Rykov again rejected the charge of organizing livestock wrecking. He again denied knowledge of Ivanov's connections with the British. But he also, backed by Krestinsky and Rosengoltz, confirmed the participation of Tukhachevsky in the bloc. Rykov's testimony was not coherent, and took no perfectly clear line, but he had still contrived to make a number of substantial denials. Next day, Sharangovich, the Belarusian First Secretary, was first to be called. After the shifts and evasions of the previous evening, he made an excellent impression on observers sympathetic to the regime, with his frank and total admission of all charges. He had been a Polish spy since 1921, and had become a prominent member of the Belarusian National Fascist Organization, whose other members included Glodid, Chervyakov, and most of the party leaders in the Republic. Rykov and Bukharin were directly involved in their crimes, which had included the formation of three terrorist groups. Two of them had been intended to attack Voroshilov during the 1936 maneuvers. Sabotage, on a large scale, had been designed to cause discontent as well as disruption. He, too, had spread disease among animals. I must also say that in 1932 we took measures to spread plague among pigs, which resulted in a high pig mortality. This was done by inoculating pigs against plague in a wrecking fashion. Further, as regards rural economy, I should like to say something about our diversionist activities in horse breeding. In 1936 we caused a wide outbreak of anemia in Belarusia. This was done intentionally, because in Belarusia horses are extremely important for defense purposes. We endeavor to undermine this powerful base in case it should be needed in connection with war. As far as I can now recall, about 30,000 horses perished owing to this measure. More essentially, he took the blame for the early excesses of collectivization. These had been put through for anti-party reasons. At that period there were still about 100,000 individual peasants in Belarusia. We gave it out that an individual peasant who failed to join the collective farm was an enemy of the Soviet power. This was done for provocative purposes. In accordance with our provocative stand, we applied to the individual peasants who resisted collectivization such taxation measures which caused discontent and an insurrectionary spirit among the individual peasants. Copyright. But fortunately Moscow had known better. Later the Central Committee of the CPSU took measures to correct what we had done, and the situation changed. The spirit among the individual peasants, among those whom we had provoked, took a distinct turn for the better. This interpretation of the events of 1929 and 1930 is a striking one, and shows a continual preoccupation with the peasantry on Stalin's part. In industry, too, the National Fascists had operated on a large scale. As to power development, here attention was mainly concentrated on the Belarusian regional power station, which feeds the industries of Vitebsk, Orsha, and Mogilev. Fuel was supplied irregularly. Construction work was interfered with. Specifically, I can mention the Kirchevsk cement works, the Orsha flax mills, the Mogilev pipe foundry, Asian nationalists. The Uzbek leader Kodzhaev followed Sharangovich. It will be convenient to take his case together with that of his colleague Ikrimov, though the latter gave evidence the following day. Hitherto bourgeois nationalism had been represented by Sharangovich and, to a lesser extent, Grinko. In the persons of the two Uzbeks, it was put forward in a more forthright form. They were not mobile apparatchiks like the two just named. Their entire careers had been spent in Central Asia, where they had successfully fronted for the imposition of Moscow rule on long recalcitrant populations. They represented, as others represented in their different spheres, a much larger set of party and state officials, implicating the First Secretary and Chairman of the Council of People's Commissars in neighboring Tajikistan, for example, as well as their own republic's deviationists. Kodzhaev seems to have really resented in some degree the centralizing and denationalizing tendencies of Stalinism, but Ikrimov had not. In fact, they had led to opposed factions in the Uzbek party, and they now attributed their alleged unity in struggling against the regime to pressure from the rightist central group. Ikrimov testified, under the pressure of Bukharin and the direct guidance of Antipov, the two nationalist organizations coordinated their work. Equals. Kodzhaev was by far the most prominent and effective Uzbek to have taken the communist side right from the time of the revolution, in the struggle against the old emir of Bukhara. He had been a member of the Uzbek Central Committee Bureau since the first Congress of the Uzbek Party in 1925, and had long served as chairman of the local Council of People's Commissars. But he had not even been elected a delegate to the 7th Congress of the Uzbek Communist Party, ending on June 17, 1937. On 27 June, His removal from the chairmanship of the Uzbek Council of People's Commissars and expulsion from the Uzbek Central Executive Committee were announced, together with an attack on his counter-revolutionary nationalist positions. He was clearly under arrest by this time. His brother, also prominent in the local party, committed suicide. On 8 September, Kodzaev and seven others, including four members of the bureau of the local Central Committee, were denounced as enemies of the people, and Ikhramov, the first secretary of the republic, and the current local bureau, censured for insufficient vigilance. 2 days later, Pravda violently attacked Ikhramov for defending a Trotskyite secretary of the Uzbekistan Central Committee. Ikhramov was at this time in Moscow and, still not under arrest, had been confronted with Bukharin, Kodzaev, Antipov, and others. He denied their testimony against him, in spite of four conversations with Yazhov. A letter to the Uzbek Central Committee signed by Stalin and Molotov now drew its attention to the evidence against Comrade Ikhramov, as apparently proving not merely political blunders, but also connections with the Trotskyite, rightist group. The letter also proposes that the Uzbek Central Committee consider the question of Comrade Ikhramov and inform. 9967. The Central Committee of the All-Union Communist Party of its opinion. On 12 September, it was announced that Ikhramov had been unmasked and expelled from the party, and his case handed over to the investigating authorities. He had been arrested on Stalin's personal instructions. Registered. The Uzbek press now attacked him for weakness towards bourgeois nationalism, and specifically for supporting Kodzaev. It was presumably in support of Kodzaev that Ikhramov had protested in 1937 against the purge, and thus incurred Stalin's displeasure. As an otherwise loyal Stalinist, Ikhramov was the first defendant in the public trials to be rehabilitated. When his arrest was announced to the party membership in Tashkent, the news was greeted with warm applause. He was confronted in jail with Bukharin, who again implicated him, but he only confessed on the sixth or seventh day of the interrogation. Similar events, with similar timing, were sweeping Soviet Asia, as we saw in Chapter 8. In Kyrgyzstan, the chairman of the Council of People's Commissars was purged on 12 September, and a call put out for ruthless measures against the local Central Committee. In Tajikistan, the chairman of the Council of People's Commissars, Rakhimbaev, arrested on September 9, 1937 at a Youth Day meeting at the Park of Rest and Culture, the president, Shatomer, Ashirov and Frolov, secretaries of the Central Committee, and a number of others were denounced as nationalists or spies on 10-12 September. Rakhimbaev was accused in addition of keeping a harem of three wives. After the trial, Pravda again denounced these local leaders and other swine. Under the cold lights of the October Hall, Kodzaev now confessed that he had been anti-Soviet since 1920. He and Ikhramov had been in contact with the Rights, through Antipov, and had been instructed to work with the British for the secession of Uzbekistan as a British protectorate. They had done a good deal of industrial sabotage on much the same lines as Sharangovich's. Errors of planning had been intentional. The ramp for the delivery of coal was planned for a capacity of 75,000 kilowatts, whereas the powerhouse was built for 48,000 kilowatts, and the planned capacity of the station is 70,000 kilowatts. You see, therefore, that the elements of wrecking were present in the very planning of the station. Their agricultural policy had been disastrous, and this was also intentional, as it caused hostility to Moscow. Kodzaev. Wyshynsky, Kodzaev. This would have meant causing enormous discontent among the people, because we put it to them in this way, this is the Moscow plan, we are merely the servants of Moscow, we are carrying out Moscow's instructions. Don't you like it? Then complain to Moscow. This is the task we set ourselves. A provocative task? A provocative task, set deliberately, and pursued for a number of years. What did it lead to? It actually led to the destruction of the rotation of crops system, it led to diminution in the number of cattle, it led to a diminution in silk cultivation, because even here we pursued our wrecking activities, and in the long run it led to a diminution even of the cotton yield. And that is why for years Uzbekistan failed to fulfill its cotton plans. If a peasant had 10 hectares of land, he had to sow 8 or 9 hectares with cotton. You will understand that if only 1 hectare is left for all the rest, the farm goes to ruin. But there was a more important economic aim, to develop an independent economy in Uzbekistan. This, in contradiction to the admissions made above, led to their planning the economy in such a way as to have less cotton, because it was an industrial crop which most of all bound Uzbekistan with the Union. Secondly, we planned to develop agriculture in Uzbekistan so as to have more grain farming not only on the non-irrigated lands, but also on the irrigated lands, in order to be independent of Russian grain, and lastly, we plan the development of industry, road building, etc., in such a way as to be more economically independent than ever of Soviet Russia, of the Soviet Union, at the end of the first five-year plan. The economic side of bourgeois nationalism was thus well shown, and Coates I have made it explicit. I do not know whether the court is aware that the bourgeois nationalists, particularly in Central Asia, had a theory of organizing a self-contained economy, that is to say, of making the economy of the republic develop independently of the other parts of the Soviet Union, of making it possible for the republic to live without need for the rest of the Soviet Union in the event of possibilities arising for active, direct struggle. Akhramov gave similar evidence. He had had contacts with Zelensky, Antipov, and A.P. Smirnov, and Bukharin had stayed with him for a few days in 1933. Bukharin, called on, admitted discussing with him the Ryutin platform, and a vague allusion to terrorism, but denied any talk of wrecking. At a further meeting, in 1935, the sinister point was raised that both Bukharin's and Akhramov's wives had been present, though the seditious conversation had taken place in their absence. Bukharin denied that on this occasion politics had been discussed at all. Here came a sharp exchange with Vyshinsky. Vyshinsky, and you, the leader of an underground organization, met a member of your organization, one whom you enlisted, met him 2 years later, and did not try to verify whether he still adhered to your counter-revolutionary organization. You showed no interest in this, but began to discuss the weather in Uzbekistan. Is this how it was, or not? Bukharin. No, this is not how it was. You are putting a question which contains in itself an ironical reply. As it happens, I figured I would meet Akhramov again, but by chance this meeting did not take place because he did not find me in. Vyshinsky, you have an extraordinarily good memory for exactly those meetings which did not take place. Bukharin, I do not remember the meetings which did not take place, because they are a phantom, but I do remember those which did materialize. Akhramov gave a long account of Antipov's vital role in organizing Central Asian subversion. Antipov had insisted on terrorism, and personally boasted that whoever the Reichs had decided to kill would never reach Central Asia. Trademark and Akhramov, too, implicated the polygamist Trakimbayev and his Tadvik group to ruin the economy. The examinations of Rosengoltz and Krestinsky on the evening of 4th of March were satisfactory to the prosecution. Rosengoltz and Krestinsky testified that they, with Ruzatak and Gamernik, had constituted the main center of the conspiracy after the arrest of Rykov and Bukharin in February 1937. They had then relied almost entirely on the projected army coup. Their connections with German espionage, arranged through Trotsky, had dated back to 1922, 1923. Krestinsky admitted to the meeting with Trotsky in person which he had denied on 2nd of March. Trotsky had given full instructions for all types of treason, espionage, sabotage, and terror. The only slightly awkward moments were when Krestinsky said that he, Rosengoltz, and Gamernik had discussed the necessity for a terrorist act against Molotov, but had made no actual preparations for it. Vyshinsky commented sharply that this amounted to the same thing, and when Rykov, again called on briefly to confirm conversations with and about Tukhachevsky, denied them. Rykov and Bukharin, too, were incidentally all but exculpated of all the recent activity attributed to them by Krestinsky's remark that Trotsky said that we should not confine ourselves to Rykov, Bukharin, and Tomsky, because although they were the recognized leaders of the Reichs, they had already been compromised to a great extent and were under surveillance, so that Ruzatak, whom no one suspected, should be the connection. But this surveillance, and the admission that it made Rykov and Bukharin unsuitable conspiratorial colleagues, in effect disposes of the possibility of their guilt, and this from 1933 on, covering the whole period of the Kirov and other alleged murders. Rosengoltz confessed to various embezzlements, including sabotage in the export of iron. This seems to refer to pig iron exports, which in fact had been under a directive bearing Stalin's signature, with the delivery superintended by Yezhov. Rakovsky was now questioned. He was the son of a landowner in the southern Dobruja, at first part of Bulgaria, but transferred to Romania a few years after his birth. He was prominent as a Bulgarian socialist at the age of 20, when he represented the party at the Congress of the Second International. He took a doctorate of medicine at Montpellier, and went back to the Balkans, where he was arrested a number of times for involvement in the Romanian revolutionary movement. In 1916, he was again arrested in Romania, and imprisoned at Jassy, where the Russians freed him in May 1917. He went to Petrograd and in 1919 became a member of the Central Committee of the Russian Communist Party and chairman of the Council of People's Commissars of the Ukraine. Becoming attached to Trotsky's views, he lost his high posts and from 1924 to 1927 was Soviet chargé d'affaires in London and then ambassador in Paris. He was recalled to Moscow in November 1927 and was expelled from the Central Committee in the same month, for supporting the left opposition. He defied